Golden Union Balls.ie's weekly rugby show, looking for an outside perspective on Irish rugby and on the game itself. I'm Mick McCarthy, as always, joined by Morris Brosnan. Morris, how are you?
That's good, Mick. Yeah, how about you?
Not too bad, not too bad. We'll talk about a lot of things today, but our guest is a very interesting one because we're going to talk about the laws of surrounding the ruck and how those laws aren't being applied, basically, within the modern game, and that world rugby basically rules against itself in a lot of regards. And we want to talk about why the ruck is basically not a safe place for players at the moment and how it really takes away from competition. There's almost two separate levels here. The competition aspect of it, which is being kind of eliminated a little bit by the way the laws are being interpreted or ruled at the moment, and the real serious safety issues that are going on by the way it's not being enforced.
Yeah, so Ben wrote an article that kind of...
This is Ben Cisneros from rugbyandthelaw.com. Yeah. He wrote a brilliant article about this and we'll be talking.
It kind of went like viral on rugby Twitter over the Christmas period there, yeah, where people kind of would have seen it there. But it kind of fits into this overall narrative about, like, we're all... This right now, discussion is widespread about why rugby needs to be safer, but not really enough discussion about what it actually needs to do. And that's what this article is really good at, that he establishes that there's actually existing laws that could really police it and that they aren't being applied properly.
Yeah. So looking forward to getting into that, because I have to be honest, like, what's a ruck? You know, it's like, you know, but you don't know. You know, like you could watch 50 games of rugby and it's like you'll just hear the ref go, "That's a ruck," and the player beside him will be arguing with him. You know what I mean? The rugby is so complicated in so many different ways that there's 50 interpretations every time there's a tackle. So just to get the very basics of what it is, what it's supposed to be, and why it just isn't being ruled, I suppose, governed in the way it's supposed to be at the moment, and what needs to change to make the game safer and to make it a fairer and better competition. So I'm actually really looking forward to this chat. I'm fascinated by that. I'm really, really fascinated by that article. We've been talking about it for a couple of weeks ourselves off air, so it'd be really good to get into that. We're also going to talk a little bit about some of the stuff that's happening around the world after a very interesting Heineken Cup weekend, and we're going to talk about Ron O'Gara's future and possibly some news on that. But before we do, there's something about, I don't know whether it's because the Irish teams are very good or because we're just a really good luck charm, but every time we come and do this show, we're just off the back of a weekend where all four Irish provinces sweep the board. Unless they've been playing each other, it basically happens, or Ireland have won. So just another normal weekend in Irish rugby this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, I hope nobody digs into that and finds that we've actually cursed them at one stage. But, like, it's funny, you know...
Nobody will, don't worry.
Like, there's no real overarching team from the weekend. It was kind of... It came away thinking that, you know, Munster finally back, like, first time this year they've been able to start a full-strength team, or the season, sorry. And Ulster, similarly, when they're at their best, they're very good. And then Leinster, on the other hand, when they're... you know, at their second, third best, they are also very good.
Yeah.
But in terms of the picture paints for Irish rugby, it seems like we're saying this every single week, but just emphasises the strength and depth of the players. You see, Caelan Blader looks like he's now going to be included in Six Nations squad because of the scrum half depth and the performance he's putting in Connacht. Like, if that's your sixth choice, you're in a pretty good place. Still have, you know, someone like Conor Murray to start.
Yeah, and Murray was brilliant at the weekend. Joey Carberry, I think, got all the headlines, and rightly so. He was absolutely superb. Yeah. I think I gave him a 10 in the match rating, so I can't really talk any higher than that. But there was a couple of Munster performances in particular I thought stood out, like in terms of what you're talking about there in strength and depth for Irish rugby, and even for the provinces, for Munster. Like, Stephen Archer probably gave, like, the type of scrummaging performance that would put Tyke Furlong on the back page if it happened for Ireland. He was absolutely outstanding. Made a fool of the Gloucester number one. You know, and so that's just something that we haven't really seen too much of before in a way that's made headlines like this. He was outstanding. The Tyke Byrne, again, what a performance. Yeah, him and Klein together, an amazing partnership. And if you look at Tyke Byrne's not really in the match day squad at the moment for Ireland. You know, he probably will be now if Henderson's injury kind of stretches into the Six Nations. But, you know, in terms of first choice. And then you look at Chris Farrell returning. And, like, I think I described it at one stage as basically the CJ Stander of the backs, because the amount of space he makes by just getting those hard yards, you know, almost set up that insane try that Conway got that was unfortunately forward. But even before the very first try, if you see that, Farrell had two carries that just took out 3-4 defenders, because he just can't take the man down. He's so quick and so big, and the difference he makes to Munster is huge. And you think, right, we've got Henshaw, we've got Ringrose, we've got Bundiaki, we've got whoever else. So he's probably not getting a real stiff with Ireland at the moment, but he'd do a job if he was in there.
Yeah, you know? I think the, like, I don't know if there's any other...
That's just the Munster game. Sorry to interrupt. Like, you know, if you could run that through all the games this weekend.
I don't think there's another prospect like Chris Farrell in Irish rugby at the minute in terms of somebody who's such a commanding presence and commands so much attention off defensive lines by just his hard running, but also has got like a huge skill set in terms of his handling ability, and also he's got real intelligence. Like, his defense is really clever too. I think it's kind of underappreciated, the like when he's shooting up out of the line sometimes it kind of looks kind of odd, but what he's doing is forcing Gloucester back in. Like, you saw Gloucester's try when it came out wide. The reason that they didn't have any joy trying to do that early in the game is because you got someone like Farrell shooting up on the outside, and then it's forcing you only get like, you know, one or two phases into your backline. It's the currency that's in Irish rugby at the minute, is these quick up defences, and it's something that 13s in Irish rugby in particular have kind of got down, and he's another one that kind of adds to that.
Yeah. So just to finish up on the Munster match, the best players on the pitch, without a doubt, Joey Carberry on the bench for Ireland. Andrew Conway might make the bench for Ireland, possibly not, but in again, not in the first 15.
Yeah.
Chris Farrell, then you had John Klein, who's not Irish, but
Ty Burke and Archer,
and Klein will eventually qualify. You know, none of those making the, you know, starting for Ireland at the moment. You add in Conor Murray in there as well, he was pretty good. But, you know, it just goes to show what's there. Then you go to, so, and again, Munster kind of get a bonus point win in England without much fanfare, which shows how far we've kind of come as well. Ulster, before we get to Leinster, like, we talked last week about how they kind of just weren't going to win that game.
Yeah.
And we were trying not to be disrespectful. We knew they could do it.
And we stressed that it could be a season-defining game. Yeah. And I think now it opens a... Like, I know I bring this up a lot, but at the start, I was almost fully convinced they shouldn't invest in Europe because of the pool they'd gotten. The pool was so difficult. And now they're in an unbelievable chance of getting a quarter-final place. And also, the Ulster performance, if you look at it as a whole... What's so striking is the improvements in areas where they were so poor last year. Like, I'm not talking about in terms of personnel. I'm talking about like as a set piece, and you see the difference Eric O'Sullivan has made there. I think he's one of the most underappreciated stories in Irish rugby. Like, this is the guy who was playing AI last year. Like, Eric O'Sullivan is a prop who was the leading tackler in that game for the Racing. Obviously, he was the leading tackler. He led the line, and that's before you even look at his set piece contribution. So like, the improvement in him, I think a lot of that might be down to being well coached. I think But certainly you can see that in their forwards coming up. Roy Best has actually cited that the improvements in their scrum while he was away with Ireland really struck him when he came back, and he's like, wow, this is new. Marty Moore is obviously a big part of that as well. As a whole, I think what Ulster have done is prove that when they're at their peak, you know, when they're at their best, it's just what we talked about last week. Like, you can't judge Ulster on when they're down to their second or third string against Leinster and they concede 40 points.
They don't have that depth.
Yeah, at any extent. But when they are at their best, they're very good and they're well able to compete.
Yeah. And again, a huge win. And actually, funny you say that about O'Sullivan not being appreciated, you know, or the story not being done. That will be by the coaches.
Because yeah,
just as an example, you say it reminded me because he topped the tackle count. There was Matt Williams. I remember talking to him a good few times. He's brought it up in just random conversation about the time that Emmett Byrne got 27 tackles in a game. You know, I think it might have been the famous Toulouse game where Dennis Hickey got all the headlines and Conte Pomey got all the headlines, and Matt always talks about Emmett Byrne's performance that day, you know, and he's the only one who does, but he was the coach.
Yeah.
You know, and there is that, like, you know, coaches do see these things and they also laud it and they kind of get a little bit, they're in awe by it sometimes, you know, by work rate and just giving it all for that team, and that sets up those magic moments of getting all those tries against Racing, you know. So I think that's actually a really good thing for you to bring up, because those things are important and are massive. And as you said, makes such a difference to how a team looks going into it. They have a huge chance. So we need to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah.
Leinster obviously in really good shape. If they can beat Wasps, they're going to top the group and get a home quarter final. Munster really, like, unlucky just with the group that they've had, you know, but are unlikely to get a home quarter final. They basically need Montpellier to beat Edinburgh in Edinburgh and for them to do the business at home to Exeter. And then Ulster, they're looking at the moment, they're one of the top second place teams and will go in, but they'll need to get the job done this weekend.
Like. And in terms of like what the Irish Province need to do, I think we are potentially looking at, without getting into predictions, but just in terms of permutations, I think we're looking at an All-Irish quarter-final. If Ulster can beat Leicester, they'll finish sixth. Well, right now they're in seventh, but...
Ulster are playing Leicester at Welford Road, yeah, though, so but, for all the problems yeah. Leicester have, it's not a gimme.
Yeah, although Leicester have been yeah. one of the most disappointing teams in Europe this year, to be honest.
Sure, like, no, whatever that was. Yeah,
the performance last week, again, and you're talking about a team that welcoming back in to Tuilagi, and we've talked at length about what was going on in Leicester in this podcast.
Yeah.
But again, I thought they were really disappointing last weekend. I think Ulster, with it all to play for, so like Ulster are set up a possibility of topping this pool, but it's not likely because Scarlets are also out of contention. So with Racing playing Scarlets in the other side. But
and if Ulster, Racing are at home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if Ulster can win, it looks really good for them because Glasgow are playing Saracens away, and Glasgow are currently sixth, which means Ulster will move into that position. That means that Leinster will be in third, Ulster in sixth. That sets up a quarterfinal there. If Munster get their win as well, ideally they'll finish fifth. They could still, I mean, there's... it's
they could finish fourth, but fifth is the most likely. Fifth, if they win and Edinburgh win and Leinster win, because like you have to, you know, you assume Leinster will win, even though they're, again, in England. It's strange the way we have changed our expectations over
from
the years.
Teams,
that we expect away wins against Premiership teams. But Munster are most likely to be fifth, I would think, if results go the way if favourites win.
So what that means is that Munster would play Edinburgh in the quarterfinal and Leinster would play
in
Ulster.
In Murrayfield.
Yeah.
And Leinster will play Ulster in the Aviva probably.
Yeah.
So it's not bad.
No, it's not. It looks really well from that picture. I think talking about what you just mentioned there about the away English teams, I think it'll be something that a lasting legacy of 2019 and something that's going to carry over is England's performances in Europe and what they're going to do about that, because there's absolutely no way that they'll be happy with the performances. Yeah. You look at like Saracens again, like the sole team carrying the mantle. We thought Newcastle, who started really brightly, might be able to do something else. They haven't. Exeter, who are still in contention, but if Munster win there, they're also out of it.
Yeah.
Like they
have to win in Thomond Park. Yeah.
So I think what that means for... we've seen what happened in the past with English clubs.
Basically, we know that if English clubs don't win the Heineken Cup or aren't doing well, we change the Heineken Cup.
Yeah. Or we'll stack it in a certain way.
Yeah.
And then, but the damage that the...
It's kind of like Brexit in a way, isn't it?
But the lasting legacy of the Heineken Cup as it was, it still hasn't recovered from what the English clubs did. Like the standing it had, and in terms of like commercially, it hasn't recovered from that.
No.
Even today, which it and it still is a, you know, it's a fantastic competition.
But yeah,
in terms of the potential of what it was, and suddenly you're faced with this scenario now again. You've seen this narrative about English teams not being able to rest players the week before, despite the fact that Munster had 21 or 23 players playing against Connacht last week before, and they went over to England and dismantled a pretty poor Gloucester performance in the end at home.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, and from that perspective, I don't think it essentially. We just should mention as well, Connacht, who've done, I think,
that's what I was gonna say,
Challenge Cup. It's like a nice addition to, I think they're, and they've made no shame of this, that their sole focus is to try and get into the Heineken Cup and try and progress in the Pro 14. And yet this feel good factor extends to European rugby, and now they're in with a great shout. Another brilliant performance against Sale, albeit a second half fadeaway. But in the end, like it once again underlines this fact that where Irish rugby is at right now, and where you've seen Connacht, a load of players who all of a sudden can start looking at. Finlay Beelam, I think, could really start looking towards the Ireland squad. I know he's been name-dropped by Josh Mayne.
We're
going
to have a 100-man Irish squad by
Ultimate
the end
Land
of this podcast.
Looks back to his... Ultimate Land looks really back to come back into form. I know he kind of sit away. We mentioned Callum Blade earlier. Jack Carthy is putting in incredible performances down there. Sean O'Brien, the Connacht Sean O'Brien, the better Sean O'Brien, as he's called in Galway.
Yeah.
I think he could be one of a real good reckoning. He's also a player that Smith would like in terms of, like Ty Byrne. He's very versatile. Like, he can cover back where he can play in the lock as well. So those kind of players, that's the tier that you're trying to build in terms of not necessarily, that might not even be a tier building towards an Irish play or starting for Ireland, but it's a tier in terms of building depth and competition amongst each other, like amongst the overall hierarchy of Irish rugby.
Yeah.
If you can strengthen that tier, it pushes everything on.
We should probably go to a few Wolfhound games this year. It sounds like we have a pretty good team. Great stuff. So we'll talk a little bit more about Champions Cup. We're going to talk a bit about Edinburgh and where they've come from and how they've got to the position that they're in, where they could be hosting a Munster in a quarter final. We'll talk a little bit about Ron Nogara in New Zealand and a few more stuff. But I do want to get to Ben Cisneros, who's on the line at the moment, because we're going to talk a little bit about the Rook. He's written a brilliant piece on rugbyandthelaw.com. Ben, how are you getting on?
Hi, good, thank you. Good, cheers. Cheers for having me on.
No, thanks very much for joining us. Ben, we want to talk about like the mess of the ruck as it's described in your article, and something that we're rugby are basically turning a blind eye to at times, the dangers within there, the lack of competition because of it. But first of all, I think a lot of us will freely admit that while we know what looks right in a ruck and we might be calling for turnovers and calling for penalties at times, we don't have full understanding of exactly what goes on in there. At its most basic level, can you describe what a ruck is supposed to be or what a ruck is?
Yeah, sure. Well, if you look at World Rugby's law book, Law 15 is the one that governs the ruck. And they start off by stating the basic principle that the purpose of a ruck is to allow players to compete for the ball on the ground. So obviously, play breaks down, ball ends up on the floor, and that's where the ruck's formed. And a ruck is technically formed, according to their laws, when at least one player from each team are in contact on their feet and over the ball, which is on the ground. So basically, it's to allow competition for the ball after a tackle.
Yeah, so it's supposed to be the tackler and the ball player on the ground having tackled, and then two people basically have a wrestling match to get the ball at its most basic level.
At its most basic level, exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So that's obviously not what we see week in, week out, and no. You know, but I was very fascinated to see some of the going through, and we'll talk about some of the things that are illegal and you know, we don't know they are, and they're definitely not governed as so. But even some of them, like one of the ones that I think we would know to be a penalty and is often given as one, but the off the feet clear out. You have an example of a couple of them. I know there was one on Keen Healy in the Ireland New Zealand game a few months ago. But that's something that I suppose if we're talking about the why the ruck needs to be cleaned up, that's probably one of the number one points given the dangerous level of people going off their feet. What is so dangerous about that when you're
100% agree. That's definitely one of the key issues. I mean, for me, the massive danger there is that, you know, players flying in off their feet, not just sort of going off their feet when they're in the ruck, but actually flying into the ruck, like almost launching themselves off their feet. It just means that players are completely out of control when they enter the ruck. And so if you're out of control, you know, you don't know where shoulders are going to land. You can easily make contact with people's heads, which is obviously a massive issue in rugby at the moment with sort of the recent studies that have been done. I think that's the main one for me. It's the lack of control. It's just very, very dangerous play. I mean, that example you gave of the Kian Healy incident in the Ireland All Blacks game in November was as clear an example as you like. You know, Sam Whitelock, the All Blacks, just comes flying in off his feet, no control, shoulder straight into Kian Healy's head. And I can't remember if Healy went off for a HIA or anything, but he could easily have been concussed.
We had it with, I don't know if you saw it, but we had it with Tadhg Furlong against in the Munster game.
It
was a yellow card because he said he couldn't reasonably know that his head was going to pop out there. But the fact that he went off his feet and was out of control going into the ruck suggests that, you know, if this is being taken seriously and if this is where we have to get to the next step, then that probably should be a red card regardless of him knowing it was going to be a dangerous situation or not.
Definitely. I think it's all about, you know, the thing that World Rugby are trying to do by introducing these sort of higher sanctions for contact with the head. It's all about changing players' behaviour. And you know, it doesn't matter about the outcome. If you're trying to change players' behaviour, then what matters is their intention and their awareness about what they're doing, not what might happen if someone changes their body position. You've got to go in there thinking, you know, what happens if I make contact with someone's head? You know, it's all about what the player's state of mind is. And the only way to change that is by increasing the sanctions. And I agree that Furlong incident for me probably should have been a red card because, you know, he made contact with the head and he was reckless at the end of the day. And that's exactly the sort of behaviour that the authorities are trying to stamp out, and rightly so.
Ben, I think it's kind of important to clarify as well, like, you're not advocating for new rules when it comes to the ruck. Like, we've seen new rules, for example, when World Rugby tried to clear up the scrum or even, you know, the tackle. But you're merely advocating, and in some cases advocating for the abolish maybe of 15.16b. But in general, you're just advocating that they enforce the rules that already exist.
Yeah, 100%. So for me, there's sort of four main issues with the ruck at the moment. So the flying off the feet that we've spoken about, players staying on their feet in the ruck, collapsing the ruck, or the crocodile roll, as a lot of people like to call it. And then the last one is the rule 3.17, the head below the hips one. That's the one that I think probably could be got rid of. but the first three issues could all be solved by simply applying the laws as they're written in World Rugby's own law book, which is kind of a strange position to be in. But yeah, it's pretty easy to resolve, you know.
I think it's fascinating though, looking through though. So that the reason I started with the off the feet clear out is that's something that we probably need to take more seriously. But you will agree is being at least penalised and is at least being applied, whether it's taken seriously or not. Whereas the other three, staying on the feet throughout the course of the ruck, you know, we see plenty of examples where it's missed. You will get penalised from it. But not being able to collapse or jump on top of a ruck, which I think is the name of the rule, but yeah. Crocodile roll is how we'll all know it. And the head not being below the hips are basically completely ignored. I think you even point out that, like, you know, not only do plenty of rugby players advocate and describe how to do the crocodile roll, but, you know, Nigel Owens, the most respected referee in the world, is saying it's perfectly legal. How does this happen where there is such a difference between what the laws actually say and how the laws are applied by, you know, referees and how they're being guided?
Yeah, well, I mean, it goes even further than you're saying, because actually in 2014 World Rugby made a clarification at the request of the RFU on this exact point, and that they ruled that the crocodile roll, not in as many words, but that sort of judo throw was legal. They went as far as ruling out neck rolls, obviously because of the danger to people's heads and necks, but they actually said that the sort of body throw, as you like, was perfectly fine. So that's sort of, I guess, where the difference of opinions come from. I mean, I don't know how we got to that place to begin with. I think partly it's a combination, because when sort of some rules haven't been applied, like the head below the hips rule, it means it's particularly difficult to clear players out. Similarly with the players going off their feet at the ruck, you know, if players are off their feet, you can't sort of drive them backwards. So one of the only things you can do is twist them sideways to get them off the ball. And I think that's probably how the crocodile roll came about. So actually it's sort of a cumulative effect of ignoring various laws, not necessarily deliberately, but sort of over time, it's just developed that's how the ruck works. And so it's just become accepted. But I think there's so many examples now of serious injuries occurring because of this crocodile roll. I mean, it's something that Ben Ryan, you know, former England and Fiji Sevens coach, he's been going on about it for years now, since 2014 when World Rugby made this clarification. He's been sort of a real advocate for changing that, and I think he's bang on, because, you know, I went through yesterday through YouTube just trying to find examples of injuries which have occurred, and I wouldn't recommend doing it, because some of them are pretty horror to watch. But, you know, Ellis Jenkins playing for Wales in the autumn last season, year-ending injury because of a crocodile roll. John de Villiers, Springbok captain back in 2014. James Horwill playing Super Rugby in 2012. Justin Ives playing for Japan against the World 15 in a World Cup warm-up in 2015. Virgil Bruni, Lyon player against Toulouse in 2017. In the English Championship, a player called Rob Fuller playing for Hartbury had a horrible injury last year playing against Jersey. And then also the case of Sam Jones, the Wasps player who was forced to retire because of terrible leg injury. I mean, we don't know if it was because of a crocodile roll per se, but it was in what's been described as a judo training session in an England camp. And, you know, these moves are sort of the judo-esque moves, and the fact that they're being coached and trained, it's opening players up to these sort of really serious lower limb injuries. And obviously, you know, it's not as perhaps long-lasting and disastrous for your life as head injuries could be, but certainly in terms of a career, they could be career ending. So it's something that really, really does need attention.
Definitely.
And I suppose just to clarify that as well, Ben, you're talking about the Jacklers sustaining these injuries. Like, we saw it actually recently in the Leinster Ulster game. Kyle McCall suffered a horrendous injury when he was kind of crocodile rolled off the ball by Frawley in that game. It's since been confirmed he suffered a hamstring injury there. In an ideal world, like, that jackal is something that's so kind of eye-catching, and it's a real skill in the game, probably, I suppose, for anyone more regularly who would see it, you know, the kind of the pocock approach. Like, how would you like to see that contest unfold? Like, what would your ideal scenario be?
Well, I think, like you say, the jackal is a real skill and a technique which I think probably should be rewarded in rugby. You know, what's the point of sport if we're not encouraging great bits of skill? And that is, you know, although it's not as flashy perhaps as, you know, throwing ridiculous offloads like we've seen in the Heineken Cup this weekend or anything, but it is a real skill. And I think what needs to be done is you've got to allow for that competition to take place, and you've got to allow for it to take place safely. So that involves various things. I mean, firstly, players not going off their feet. If players aren't off their feet, for a start, it's easier for a jackaler to come in and try and steal the ball. And then in terms of clearing them out, people not flying in off their feet, it's not going to be as dangerous. And then getting rid of this crocodile roll, again, it's going to make it easier for a jackaler, and it's also going to make it safer for a jackaler. So I think there's various things that can be just slightly tweaked in their interpretation, just to allow this better competition and safer competition.
And the important thing, I suppose, to note on that as well is that, you know, it's not, the point of that isn't to weight it in favour of the jackler. It's just to enforce a safe competition. Like, the teams can still stock their own rooks or have a quick clear out, and that the jackler just can't take place because once players are in contact, they can't get his hands on the ball.
Yeah. That was going to be my question, though, Ben, just as I think we can all agree in a rather straightforward way that one and two there, as I said, one which is being penalised and probably needs to have harsher punishments, two which needs to be more consistent. I think we need to get rid of them, and that's straightforward. And I think there is probably more of a conversation with three and four. As you said, four could probably be abolished so that, again, just to clarify in case we didn't, that the technical rule is that the jackal or somebody in the rook's head can't be below their hip level, which would obviously rule out the kind of the one we're used to seeing, the Pocock or the Peter O'Mahony, which is the head on the ground, arse in the air. Look, you know, but we're saying that that's a skill. Let's leave that in there. But then if that's the case, does that not give the defending team probably too much of an advantage in a ruck, probably lead to too much turnovers, lead to probably not, like, you know, takes away the scoring of the game if that, you know, if that one counter for the attacking team in the ruck, one legal counter, again, you know, they've got plenty of illegal ones that we need to stamp out, but if that's taken away, does that not give too much of an advantage to the defensive team?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting one. I think the laws really are set up very carefully to create this balance between attack and defence and also safety. And so it is, you have to be very careful when tweaking them. So this rule about head below the hips, I mean, I didn't even know it existed until I started researching for this article. And I don't think many people realise it's a rule, because it's just, I mean, I've never ever seen a free kick given for it in all the rugby I've ever watched. I suppose the purpose of that rule is because if you've got your head in line with your hips or above, it's easier for the player doing the clear out, the attacking team, to get under your shoulder and to drive you out of the way, rather than having to, you know, roll you or come in at the side or anything like that. So that's the purpose of that rule, is to allow for that competition. But I mean, to me, you know, for start, it would be a difficult rule to enforce properly if they're going to be serious about it, because, you know, sort of working out whether a player's just got his head below his hips, you know, how stringent are you going to be? And also the main one for me is that it seems to me that having your head up in a ruck is probably going to be more dangerous than if you've got it hunched down. I mean, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a statistician, so I don't know if that's exactly right, but to me it feels more exposed and the head's going to be more vulnerable. So that's why I think the rule probably should go. And then, like you say, then it's a question of, is that going to weight things too heavily in favor of the defensive team? I think that's something that you'd probably only work out once the rule was abolished. But given that, you know, it's not enforced at the moment anyway, I'm not sure how strong that case is. But certainly, you know, it would encourage probably more support play. And, you know, there are ways to ensure that jacklers don't get to the ball first. If you're, you know, if you run good support lines and you sort of really work as a team to get the players to the ruck, then it shouldn't be too heavily in favour of the defensive team. But anyway, as we said before, it's a great skill to reward. So is it necessarily a bad thing to sort of favour defences like that? I don't know.
Possibly not. No, and I think just like there is, it does kind of come again to the difference between competition and safety, and probably does always have to outweigh that. We can figure out the competition later, but it needs to be a safe game.
And I would agree with you there.
I think ultimately as well, it's probably important to note that I think this is a line in your article as well, that, you know, World Rugby eventually is going to have to take on the onus to be proactive with this kind of thing and stop being reactive. So we've seen, and that's what happened with with the scenario we have now with the tackle and with the scrum before that. And what that comes down to from a World Rugby perspective and for the kind of the sports perspective is enhancing this, because it can still be a great spectacle, like the ruck can still be a brilliant competition, but in terms of being more proactive with this, you've already not listed the injuries that have incurred. That's what you're trying to avoid with these scenarios, and for the betterment of the entire game, I think it's better all around that if it was just enforced improperly.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think there is a need for some research, and I know there's lots of sort of surveillance projects that mm-hmm. go on, and I'd be really interested to read some of the stats they have on ruck injuries and things like that. But you know, I think to everyone, it seems an obvious danger. It seems that it's something that could easily be fixed. It's not like concussion, which is an invisible injury, or you know, we're not sure exactly how it's caused or when it's caused or when the most dangerous situation is. It's pretty clear. If a player is being twisted sideways over their knee ligaments, they're probably at some point gonna snap. it's not a particularly difficult one to work out. So it just seems like it's an obvious one to clamp down on for me.
Nice and gruesome as well. Before we let you go, Ben, there's a couple of other issues in the ruck like that. I'm just wondering, have you looked into, or is and they wouldn't be from a safety point of view. It's more from clearly being illegal. For example, end of the game, there's 2 minutes to go in the game and you're running it up the jumper, and there's these kind of organized rucks where you have six guys going in together. So, you know, you can be safe, do it again, up the jumper five times, kick it out into touch. All of those lads are falling off their feet immediately. I can never understand how referees never give penalties from it unless they're in a certain mood on the, you know, phase 26 or something. But it does seem like that there is kind of a, you know, take it or leave it attitude to the rules in general, even when it's not about safety.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the end of the game is a tricky one. There's been so many instances this season already where, you know, you've seen referees just really reluctant to give penalties. And you can understand why. If it's going to be a game-defining decision, you want to make sure that it's exactly right. But at the end of the day, the laws are there to be applied. And if you don't apply the laws in the last minute, then you know, you're sort of undermining their integrity for the rest of the game. So I think it's important that they are applied in those situations. It comes back to what we were saying about players going off their feet in the ruck. It's got to be one that's applied. It allows for fair competition for the ball, whether it's in the first minute or in the last minute. You know, I agree with you there. That is a common one. Something that could be cracked down on.
Ben, fascinating stuff. Tell me, what more can we get from rugbyandthelaw.com if this is what we found? What more can our viewers expect there?
It's a relatively new blog. It's a sports law blog primarily, but it's focused on rugby union. So lots of articles about the laws, about concussion, about player welfare, governance issues, commercial issues. This week published an article about whether ring fencing the English Premiership could potentially be anti-competitive in terms of competition law, but yeah, there's plenty to get your teeth into over there. So it'd be great to get a few more readers.
Fascinating stuff. Rugbyandthelaw.com. If anybody wants to check it out, Ben Cisneros, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me on. Look forward to talking to you again.
Great stuff there, Ben Cisneros, Rugbyandthelaw.com. Really enjoyed that chat. Feel like I'm a little bit wiser about it, but also, now I'm just going to be watching games slightly differently, going, oh, crocodile roll all the time. And referees and players and everybody perfectly happy with it, and me apoplectic watching the TV.
I think, though, like the people will look at that and say, oh, well, how are you supposed to counter jackers? I know it was a point you made there as well.
Yeah, that was, but I think
there's ways you can adapt. Like, you can, we've seen lately a lot less people commit to offensive rucks. So you see, like, teams in the past might commit four, now only committing two. But if you just, you stack your own offensive rooks again, and you might be pulling out of your offensive line, but it's just small little adaptations that you do to re-emphasize that.
Of course.
But also, it makes your first up clear all the more important. Like, you're trying to win a race. I remember we spoke to Niall Ronan on site for an article, and he was talking about the best thing you can do to counter players like Pocock, but it was the example he was using, was just win the race, just get there first, so lock it off, so when he can't get down, like, you're trying to, that's all you're trying
it
to
could
do.
Speed up the ball. But as we did, look, I don't want to dwell on it too much, but we did talk about it before. I used the example of Ulster in the last couple of minutes against Clonetley, and how you can almost see it coming.
Yeah,
because defences are waiting that they're waiting that three phases until they can go for it. It is a planned thing as well. It's not that O'Matney just happens to be there at the time to go and get it, or Rory Best.
It's called almost.
Like, this is we're going to do this in four phases.
You know,
is that we're going to have a go at the ball. So that's harder to counteract. But as I said, like Ben said there, it might not be as sexy as an offload or something. When you're in the Aviva Stadium and I keep using O'Matney as the example. It could be Levy, it could be anyone, you know, jumps over the ball and we see it coming. And
oh, just builds,
the crowd
yeah.
builds a bit of noise when they realise that that whistle is coming. And then the whistle with the point
yeah.
is one of the most thrilling things in sport when it's for your team. Isn't it, though?
Yeah, yeah.
It is. Because it takes about 4 seconds to develop and there's an anticipation there all the way through it, followed by a massive release of a cheer. It's better than an offload.
And it's like the combination of factors that go into it. Like you mentioned this like preordained thing. You see somebody like Tadhg Byrne, who actually swings around, like he moves around behind rucks,
amazing,
and then
on Friday night,
like he times to perfection. Yeah, he does. And again, he's what he's doing there as well. Like it comes back to, he's just winning the race. Like he's just perfect, yeah. perfect timing, and he's got that factor of whatever about, like he's got the physical attributes to do it, but he's also in terms of his decision making about when he commits. Like he doesn't, you see often he'll linger and then if it's not on, he'll get out of the line, he'll get back into the defensive line, he won't even bother counter rucking, he'll just get out of there. So his own decision making, like his head is just as good as the ability that he has to, you know, execute it.
Without doubt. Talk to me about Edinburgh, because we mentioned them earlier as they need to beat Montpellier at home to secure a home quarterfinal, possibly against Munster in the Heineken Cup. Looking at Edinburgh from outside, you're kind of going, God, they're like well behind Glasgow. They're, you know, a team we haven't really taken seriously in about 5 years. Where has this come from?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting story. It's somebody like Richard Cockerill comes in who I think would openly admit to being kind of an old school, you know, like ball-headed
John Bolt
type,
Englishman
eyes bulging type, like yeah. yeah like he's that kind of character, and I think he's unashamedly so. I think he did an interview in the Telegraph recently where he admitted to the very first day coming into Edinburgh and telling them that they're crap, so they can't answer him back right now because until they get better they can't. And I think that was his philosophy. He also spoke about something that's kind of interesting. I think it says a lot about maybe how smaller clubs can, you know, market themselves and also improve. He felt like there was a lot of players floating around hoping for Scotland call-ups and not hoping for Edinburgh to progress, that should be your priority. Mm. And then a consequence of that is that you get Scotland call-ups. And I think, like, Cockerill is an interesting scenario. He obviously got sacked by Leicester, as something we spoke about in the past. He went to Toulon. He's actually spoken really positively about what Mike Ford did for him in terms of, as a coach, he was kind of at a low ebb there. And Ford kind of took him under his wing. He was allowed to be a forwards coach. And it's funny to see, since he's arrived in Scotland, the improvement in Edinburgh's front five, but like simultaneous with him coming in there. I think there's a lot of real good field factors about Scotland. The eye catchers are guys like, you know, Villamy Mata, who looks this Fijian number 8, Olympic gold medal winner with the sevens team. And he's just, you know, this machine, this offloading arsenal that they have.
Yeah.
But in terms of their actual, like their drilled down places, they're really, I think Scotland rugby is in a good place right now. You look at what, you know, Edinburgh and Glasgow,
yeah.
both in competition. Like, this is despite the fact that Stuart Hogg is going to Exeter. They've got Finn Russell, obviously, who's playing out in France.
Yeah.
And yet they're still able to build up a part of his brief. And this is something I think Premiership teams are looking at with him, with Cockerill. Like, he has never been briefed to develop players because relegation is always such an immediate threat. And it's why we get this talk about ring fencing from a player's perspective, but not when it becomes more about owners, it's a different story. That's not the intention of it.
Mm.
But what he can do, and something that he's openly admitted to being told to do, is develop Scottish players along yeah. with that. So you've seen them progress too. So as a club, not only do they develop in terms of the short term, the long term prospects look really good. And again, when you've got somebody like Cockerill who has openly admitted that he wants to try and win the league in the next couple of years with Edinburgh, like to come yeah. out and boldly state that, and now he's backing it up in Europe and also simultaneously in the Pro 14. I think it's kind of an exciting prospect, and it shows, like, we talked about this with the Dragons as well, actually, in Wales. I don't think anybody would ever expect Edinburgh to win the Champions Cup. But what Cockerill is doing is maximising what is at his disposal. If you can, you know, maximise the utensils yeah. that are there. Something that Connacht are also finally doing now.
Yeah, it's true.
Then
yeah.
that's improvement. That's just as much success as a team like Leinster, who we would expect to, you know, achieve silver, will eventually get.
Yeah. Look, we talked at the start of the show about the Irish provinces winning all again and stuff. It's something that we're sometimes a little bit uncomfortable with as an underdog nation, is being the front runners. And
yeah,
we very
yeah.
much are in the Pro 14. And it's sometimes we do have to remove ourselves a little bit from that and say, where are the underdog stories?
Yeah.
And Edinburgh kind of coming back up and kind of getting to that level, where Edinburgh were a very good team 6 or 7 years ago, you know, and to get back up to that point again is actually a very, very good news story. And the league badly needs it. And the more of it we can see, the better. Talk to me a little bit about Ron Nogara's future in New Zealand. We don't know anything about Ron Nogara's future in New Zealand, but Scott Robertson, the Crusaders coach,
is
starting to look towards a move up, isn't he?
So this is something that has been on. Last December, people probably would have seen that there was rumours that Scott Robinson might not be a future candidate for a New Zealand coach. He's never really publicly commented on it. It wasn't something he did until yesterday, when he did admit that that was something he definitely wanted to do. He also, funnily, in the same press conference, admitted that he would like to work abroad in terms of building up his CV. Yeah. Like, this is a man who's had a lot of success. Like, you'd think a CV is impressive enough, not as bad, it is.
Yeah.
And despite
they've
that...
They've won twice
in a row. He's also... Like, he's... Brogar, you speak to O'Gara about him, and he's renowned for his rugby brain. It's something that is he's really praised for. Even in a scenario where we talk about New Zealand trying to promote from internally, if Ian Foster becomes the thing and there's a succession plan to that, Robinson is probably the ideal number two in a scenario like that.
Is he too big a name to do 4 years as a number two?
It's a good question, but I think in New Zealand, if there's a view towards the idea that he will eventually be getting the job, I think he might do it. Yeah, I think especially that now that he's publicly admitted that it's an ambition of his. But all this, in terms of a New Zealand perspective, that's one thing, and they will have, you know, somebody like Foster, who I think is also pretty highly regarded as well.
But there's a man in waiting.
Exactly. But that all means is that you've got somebody like O'Gara, who would have served a 2-year apprenticeship at that stage as an assistant coach, who Robinson definitely likes and he's publicly acknowledged that. Suddenly, it looks like he is the, you know, standout candidate to become the head coach of Crusaders. Like, one of the biggest clubs in world rugby, and an Irishman who went abroad to be their assistant coach is now looking increasingly likely to progress that.
It's true. Again, we should always take ourselves out of the Irish kind of small, you know, it does happen in the rest of sport, but probably not in rugby. Like, Ron O'Gara is a legend of the game who has 120 caps for
a top tier nation.
He's not a nobody either. He'd be a big name even in New Zealand, but it's more that he's taken this different route than everybody else. Even some of the guys have gone to France, that's great, but like, to go Southern Hemisphere to just rip it up, and for that to be such successful that we're even talking about him in this regard. I do worry, though, that Super Rugby teams tend to appoint coaches from their own country, especially in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Now, that might not matter. It might be just a coincidence because there's so many good coaches down there, as we know up here. And it could be an availability thing. But O'Gara does seem the person in line if the job becomes available.
Yeah, and I mean, that's true. Whatever O'Gara's gone, he's broken the mold, and you would think that he would carry that over, and he could certainly implement that in Crusaders as well.
It's fascinating to see. Coach are probably the biggest club. Well, are they the biggest club in the world? They're the top probably performing club. Leinster could be the biggest club in the world.
It's funny. I remember last year after Leinster did the double, there was a debate about who would win in a one-off game, but that's not the... Like, that we can't say that's just the criteria for the biggest club in the world in terms of, you know, that regard. Like, you've got to look at probably attendances.
So Leinster's average attendance, I think, in the league a couple of years ago was like around 20,000. So that would account for I think generally sold out RDS and the one game against Munster and Diviva, and I don't think it counts European games. And I know that Super Rugby, you're probably hitting 13, 14, 15 for most of those New Zealand teams. So in that regard, you're probably bringing in a bigger crowd at Leinster, and also there's room for more in those games. You know what I mean? There's a lot of sellouts. I don't know. Then you have to take into account the English and French teams, but you have to add success, talent level, the amount of internationals, how appealing it is to join this club. Leinster would have to be, you know, considering the fan base as well.
I definitely, like,
as
I think,
big a club as there is now, it does take up a huge area of it's like a major European capital city plus 11 counties is what Leinster have, you know, with no competition whatsoever.
But I think there's also the fact that, like, I don't think anybody in Super Rugby would probably regard Leinster as even competition. I don't think they look towards European rugby at all. I remember...
Oh, no, it's just more would O'Gara be coaching the biggest club in the world?
Yeah, like, I remember Sean Cronin talking after the Ireland-New Zealand game that Savelle was chatting to Ringrose after the game and asking him, so is your season over now or what? Like, this was in November. So I think we don't penetrate their
consciousness really exist at all. They just play us twice a year.
But
and at the World Cup,
it could be amazing to get a Super Classico, like a Leinster Crusaders, the winner of Super Rugby versus the winner of the...
I can't understand why it doesn't happen. They've had it in rugby league forever, the NRL champions against the Super League champions. Now, it's not their countries rather than you know, entire continents. But
and maybe
why not? Like, yeah. I mean, let's do it. You know, there's surely a date in the calendar we could do it. And just get that one off and do it in Europe 1 year during the November window and do it in the summer in the Southern Hemisphere.
The other side, yeah. I'm sure there's a lot of players who the last thing they want is more rugby, but it's a one-off game, I think.
Depends how seriously it's taken. The last thing you want to do is go down to New Zealand so that you can have a challenge game against the Crusaders.
Yeah.
But if it matters for some reason, I don't know why, a big shiny cup.
I'm on board.
Yeah, a big shiny cup. That's what Leinster need to win. They haven't got enough of them. So, listen, that's all the time we have for it. We're out of time. We're getting furiously wrapped up by our producer Robbie here, so he's I think his head is about to explode, so we better go, or I could just keep talking and annoy him even more. What do you think? No, I'm gonna wrap it up. Listen, we'll be back with you next Tuesday for more World in Union. Have a good week.